Welcome to That Medic Podcast, your bi-weekly dose
of all things digital health, global health, and leadership.
My name is Success, a student at Cambridge University.
And I am Simmer, a student at Harvard University.
Join us as we chat with some top professionals in healthcare. Enjoy.
In today's show, we spoke to Dr. Rebecca Poole, an internationally renowned expert on weight stigma and a professor of human development and family sciences at the University of Connecticut. We discussed how we as a society should understand stigma, how new anti-obesity drugs like Ozempic and Wegovy might be affecting weight stigma, and why it's so important for doctors and other healthcare professionals to work across research, education, and advocacy. Today's show is perfect for anyone excited about public health approaches to tackling obesity, or just intrigued by the relationship between stigma, discrimination, and health. So without further ado, let's have a listen. Hi, Dr. Poole, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for taking the time out to speak with us.
Thanks for having me.
We normally start the podcast by asking the question, why did you decide to go into healthcare?
Well, you know, I went to graduate school for clinical psychology, and my primary interest at that point was eating disorders prevention. I had seen around me a lot of eating disorders when I was in university as an undergraduate, and it just felt like a problem that was out of control, and it was something that I wanted to learn more about. So I started really with that aim in mind, although that's not where I ended up.
Oh, that's wonderful. And I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit more about that program. I know you did your PhD in clinical psychology at Yale. What was that experience like? Why did you decide to make that your career?
So, you know, what I really liked about Yale's clinical program is it's a very research-focused program. And so while students are certainly trained to be licensed practicing clinicians, they are also trained as really rigorous researchers. And I think that's really important because we really want any kind of clinical practice to be evidence-based, to be informed by cutting-edge research. And I think that's a very key combination. And so I really liked that approach with the program. And I actually fell in love with the research as soon as I got there. And that really changed the trajectory of my career as I really decided to pursue the research full time.
Oh, that's wonderful. And I know you spent some time at Yale after earning your PhD, and you're now the deputy director of the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Health at the University of Connecticut. So for our listeners who may not be familiar, can you describe why the Rudd Center was founded and some of the important work the center does today?
Sure. So the Rudd Center was actually founded when we were back at Yale. It was founded in 2005 by Kelly Brownell, who was my mentor when I was a graduate student. And essentially, we were funded by the Rudd Foundation. And the mission of the Rudd Center is essentially that we believe that everyone, regardless of who they are, where they live, what they look like, deserves the opportunity to eat healthfully. Right now, that's not the reality. So we're really, as a center, committed to trying to interrupt that cycle with research to try to inform advocacy and policy, supporting evidence-based solutions where we can. We're not afraid to challenge the status quo. And we're also willing to really hold the food industry and the media and the government and others that really affect the food environment accountable. And so we really try to address this in a multidisciplinary way. Our center is very multidisciplinary with faculty and researchers from psychology, public health, economics. And we study a range of different factors that affect the food environment, including food marketing, the charitable food system, and weight stigma, which is my area of research.
Right. No, certainly. I think something that's notable about the Rudd Center is that it was focusing on weight stigma long before anyone else was focusing on that. So you're, of course, world renowned for your work on weight bias and stigma. I was wondering if you could share how that interest first emerged and what's the specific focus of your research today?
Sure. So, you know, I didn't intend to have a career focusing on weight stigma. It wasn't part of my plan. And when I arrived at Yale as a graduate student, there were a couple of opportunities that really put this issue on my radar. The first is, from a research perspective, my mentor, Kelly Brownell, at the time had asked if I was interested in really doing some research to understand what was known about weight stigma at that time. And it was honestly not a term that I was very familiar with. And I immersed myself in the literature and very quickly became aware that, you know, this is a problem that seems to be facing a lot of people. But at that time, this was back in 1999, 2000, there really was not a lot of research in this area being conducted, and it was very scattered. And so it was clear that, you know, look, it looks like there's a real problem here, but that it's not really being investigated. There are a lot of unanswered questions, and that really piqued my interest. At the same time, I was in my clinical training, and I was working with people who were dealing with disordered eating and different kinds of weight struggles. And I saw very quickly that weight stigma kept emerging as a theme. It kept emerging as a barrier that they were confronting, that it was affecting their emotional health, their physical health, their quality of life. And so these two experiences really kind of collided at the same time, the clinical experience and the research experience. And I just really felt that this was a problem that needed to be addressed. And I didn't really see very many people focusing on it. And so that really changed the direction of my career. I've been doing research on weight stigma ever since and really haven't looked back. And my research addresses weight stigma from many different angles. So, you know, some of our early work was really trying to identify the nature and the prevalence of weight stigma and discrimination affecting people. But we've also done research looking at how it impacts people's health, their emotional well-being, their physical health. We look at its presence in different kinds of domains in society. So we look at it in healthcare, in the media, in schools, in employment, and also in family relationships. We look at how these experiences affect children in terms of being bullied about their weight. And we also always are doing research to look at different remedies to address weight stigma and discrimination. And I've done a number of studies looking at policy implications in particular, which we can talk more about.
No, certainly. And I think that's the interesting thing about weight stigma. It operates at various different levels, so it requires interventions across different levels. You've previously spoken about this socio-ecological framework and the need to intervene widely. So I was wondering if you could briefly introduce our listeners, what is this framework and why is it so important?
So when we talk about stigma, we're talking about societal devaluation of people. And in the case of weight, it's because of their weight or body size. And we live in a society where negative weight-based stereotypes are very common. And those stereotypes are reinforced by broader systems in society, whether it's the media, government, employers, but we also see it at a very individual level. And part of that is because we see so many messages in our society through the mass media that reinforce personal responsibility and personal blame for body weight. And so no one is really immune to these negative attitudes in our society. And there are a lot of studies that have been done on this and kind of compared weight bias to other forms of bias in our society. And what's interesting is we start to see other forms of bias improving. We're not really seeing that with weight. As a result, and as a result of the research that we and others have done, we see that weight stigma really is operating from the individual level right up to the broadest levels of society. And so trying to target intervention at just one level is not going to be very effective. And so far, research has primarily tried to target weight stigma interventions at the individual level through education, through information, to try to shift people's attitudes. And, you know, we're not seeing particularly optimistic results from those studies. It's possible to shift knowledge, and it's possible to see some short-term differences, but not the kind of significant shifts that we would want to see for societal change. And so what this is telling us is that we need broader level interventions. You know, we need to be thinking about the ways that body weight is communicated by the mass media and entertainment media and social media and news media. But we also need to look at the policy level. And, you know, we live in a country right now where in almost everywhere in the country, it is legal to discriminate against people because of their weight. So there are no protections in place that we see for other stigmatized characteristics like gender or race. We're starting to see a little bit of shift in that area, which is exciting. So Michigan is a state that actually passed a state law back in the 1970s to prohibit weight discrimination. And since then, we really haven't seen much policy change at the state level. But we're starting to see interest from states like Massachusetts, for example, who have been trying to pass a law like this for some time. And of course, recently, New York City passed legislation as well, which makes it the largest city and one of half a dozen cities really across the country now to pass this legislation. So, you know, we are seeing policy efforts start to emerge. It's a very slow process, I will say. You know, we've been studying this for a long time, and it's not moving as quickly as I would like it to, but it is moving in the right direction.
No, that's certainly really interesting, the growing movement of banning weight discrimination. You know, many of our listeners are currently students. They'll go on to be doctors, nurses, clinical psychologists, and more. You know, but I think something that I hear often is that why is stigma bad in the sense that isn't this helpful to promote healthier behaviors? And people often point to smoking and how stigma was what helped get people to quit smoking and reduced lung cancer rates, et cetera, et cetera. So I was wondering if you could speak about that argument that people often bring up, and also why you think our listeners should care about weight stigma, should care about fighting weight stigma in their own realms of society.
Yeah, so let's start with the perception that stigma is a good thing. So, you know, what's interesting is that is a common misperception, but what we've seen from a couple of decades of research evidence is that it actually has the opposite effect, that weight stigma actually predicts weight gain and obesity over time. And there are a couple of reasons for this. If we think about, well, what are the mechanisms? Well, when people are stigmatized about their weight, when they are shamed about their weight, this often leads people to turn to things like disordered eating or unhealthy eating behaviors or increased food intake. We also see it tends to decrease physical activity, oftentimes because physical activity settings are where people feel vulnerable to being stigmatized or shamed about their weight. And we also see evidence showing elevated physiological reactivity in response to weight stigma, which can contribute to weight gain as well. So, you know, I think it's paradoxical, but I think it's important to understand that weight stigma is not an appropriate or effective motivator for health behavior change or for weight loss. It does not provide incentive. And I think that we know in general that shame is not an effective motivator. You know, I think another difference, you know, you mentioned smoking. You know, smoking was stigmatized. The behavior of smoking was stigmatized. But that's a little bit different than what we see with weight stigma, where a person's character is stigmatized. Right, they are treated as second-class citizens in our society, and the stereotypes that we see related to weight very much have to do with personal willpower and character and laziness and things like that. That makes it a very different kind of stigma. And so, I think the second question you asked is, you know, why should folks who are training in a medical healthcare environment care about this? Well, first of all, if we just look at prevalence rates of obesity and overweight, the majority of patients that people see, regardless of what specialty they are in, will have higher body weight and higher body sizes. We know that for people who have obesity, for example, as many as 40% are experiencing weight stigma. It's a really high percentage. And this has implications for healthcare. One of the reasons is that weight stigma is present in healthcare settings. And there's a couple of decades of evidence documenting negative attitudes and stigma among healthcare providers across a range of specialties. And what we see is that even if this is unintentional, that these biases can really affect quality of care. So we see when patients feel stigmatized about their weight, not only does this lead to poorer provider-patient communication, it leads to reluctance to seek health services, it leads to doctor shopping and avoidance of healthcare. So it has some very tangible, concerning outcomes for patient care, and it really does need to be something that's prioritized. And one of the things that I have found interesting is just the lack of this topic being on the radar in medical education. So we see, for example, other forms of stigma and bias being integrated to some degree in different content curriculum, but we're not seeing that with weight stigma. And there are, you know, a couple of places where it could logically go. It could certainly be a part of existing diversity curriculum that's included, but it could also be included into curriculum on obesity and nutrition, which also tends to be a little bit lacking in medical education in terms of where we want to see it. So I think in terms of changes that we need to see in the medical community, part of that change is ensuring that medical students are getting the information about what weight stigma is, how it affects their patient's health, how it affects patient care, and what they can do to help reduce that weight bias in their clinical practice.
No, I think this is a really important discussion. And it speaks to some of the work the Rudd Center and you do in terms of education, right? Setting the record straight, trying to advocate for that in educational settings that this topic is more focused. So I want to shift a little bit towards that, right? The Rudd Center aims to address weight bias and discrimination through research, education, and advocacy. And you do so in your work as well. So we've already talked a little bit about your research. I was wondering if you could talk specifically about some of the education and advocacy work you've done.
Sure. So, you know, we really do advocacy work differently depending on which kind of setting we're focused on. So if we take healthcare, for example, one of the things that we have spent a lot of time doing is really converting research into evidence-based educational resources that can be tangibly used by clinicians. And I'll tell you that one of the most common questions I get from healthcare providers is, how do I talk about weight? How do I bring this up? What do I say to my patient? And so, you know, we did a number of studies really looking at what kinds of language and terminology people feel most comfortable with when it comes to their body size for that reason, so that we could really create evidence-based resources that explain to clinicians, okay, here's the kind of language that patients feel is stigmatizing, but here's what they feel comfortable with, and here's how you can talk about it. The language piece in particular is a really topical area right now. There are a lot of very strong opinions and often opposing opinions about what words we use to talk about weight. And so this is a time where it's particularly important to be sensitive to what that language is and the diverse perspectives that exist, because it's very easy for patients to feel stigmatized in that patient-provider education and patient-provider interaction. So we spend a lot of time really trying to create evidence-based resources in a way that can be tangibly used by healthcare professionals. Now, if we're working on other stigma-related topics, those advocacy efforts look different. So, for example, in our research looking at weight-based bullying in children, we find that in the United States, weight-based bullying is one of the most prevalent forms of bullying that students are experiencing. But when we look at anti-bullying policies that exist in schools, we see that a lot of the time, again, weight is not on the radar. We see that the strength of school-based policies really varies considerably from one district to another, from one state to another. And so part of our efforts there have been creating a model policy language for what schools need to do to ensure that body weight is being addressed in their efforts to curb bullying. So it really, again, depends on who we're working with. And, you know, I think one of the critical parts of the mission of the Rudd Center is that we don't just do research for the sake of doing research. We do research for the sake of changing policy, educating the public, trying to shift societal attitudes. And that has really been, I think, one of the factors that has made our center so successful, because, you know, we feel like some of the most important work happens after you publish a research study. And we spend just as much time on it after it's been published. So we spend time writing about our findings for the broader public. We work a lot with the media. We write things like policy briefs when it's policy relevant findings. We write different resources for healthcare providers and employers and parents and teachers. So depending on the audience we're trying to reach with this research, we really spend targeted efforts on how to communicate that in a way that will be impactful. And I will tell you that this is not something that most researchers get trained to do. You know, it's not something that we see in graduate school. And I think it really needs to be there, because we want researchers to be able to communicate and disseminate their research findings to people other than researchers. You know, researchers are important. When we go to conferences, we're you know, talking about our research and getting that information out there, but it's to like-minded people who are in the scientific community. And a lot of times the people who are going to make a difference and use that information for tangible action are not researchers. So we need to really spend more time training. And that's something that we do at the Rudd Center. We train graduate students and postdocs as well as undergraduates in this area and really try to help them become more comfortable talking about and communicating about their work in ways that feel a little bit unusual, because as researchers, we're trained to speak a certain way about our work, and that's not always the most effective way.
No, I think that's really refreshing, because I totally agree with you that it feels that healthcare and just science in general can often be siloed. You have many basic scientists who are doing really incredible work, but it just sits on a shelf or sits in a patent and never comes to the market, for example. And you see this at sort of every step of this care continuum, as I like to call it. So I think the main criticism, though, of trying to work across the care continuum that I've heard is that, oh, if you're trying to do it all, you're not going to be able to realize your full potential in any one domain. You're not going to be able to be the best researcher or be the best educator or the best advocate. So I'm curious to get your perspective on that critique and why you think it's so important to bridge these disciplines regardless.
Well, I think we live in a time now where team science has been recognized as highly valuable because we are bringing different perspectives to the table. And typically, things aren't as successful when we are siloed or are working in kind of our little box and not thinking about other perspectives or thinking more fully and or more comprehensively about the problems we're trying to address. And I think there's a lot of evidence that that really is the most effective approach to take. You know, I can speak for myself as a psychologist. You know, I work with many people who are not psychologists, who do work in this area, who are from public health or public policy or law or anthropology or nutrition or obesity, or, you know, the list goes on and on. And some of the most important collaborations and kind of products or projects that we've been involved in have been those that really bring multiple people to the table from these different fields. And when it's something like policy change that you're after, it's not going to happen unless you have collaboration across multiple disciplines and areas. It's just simply you need collective efforts to have that change. So I'm certainly a firm believer in that. I think in terms of, you know, how do you be someone who's a researcher and someone who communicates to these broad audiences? You know, I look at that as a responsibility of my work. And it's something that does take time. So, for example, every week I spend, you know, a number of hours talking to reporters and educating them on our work and sharing our research with them. And yes, it's time consuming. And yes, it takes me away from some of the other projects I'm working on. But if we're not getting the information out there, what's the point, right? And so I feel like it goes hand in hand. These two things go hand in hand. And I think that's how we need to really be training our upcoming generations of healthcare professionals, regardless of whether they're in research or clinical care. It's really being able to work together in these different ways.
No, I like what you said. What's the point, right? If you're just not going to make it accessible, right? It's great to talk among researchers, as you were saying, right? But it's the public, it's policymakers, it's business leaders who might be able to sometimes make something more actionable. So, you know, I think we're in a really interesting cultural moment right now, with a lot of people starting to think deeply about obesity, with the rise of Ozempic, Wegovy, or semaglutide as they're known, and the corresponding controversy over some of these weight loss drugs. I'm curious that with all this renewed attention on obesity, how do you think this will impact weight stigma specifically?
Yes, you know, I think that's really an empirical question that we're going to have to look at. You know, there are concerns that it will increase stigma, and there are arguments that it will actually reduce stigma, that because it will focus on obesity as a very complex, multifactorial issue with an etiology that really is not just about personal willpower or choice. So, you know, you can kind of see it from both ways. I will say, though, that you know, we're already starting to see some backlash. And what I think is unfortunate is that this is now doubly stigmatizing people with high weight. So they're stigmatized for having high weight, and then they're stigmatized for how they lose weight. We've seen that with bariatric surgery as well. So, you know, oftentimes people are stigmatized for, quote unquote, choosing the easy way out through surgery. And medication could have that same vulnerability. That I think is really problematic, you know, that we're stigmatizing people for their body size and then stigmatizing them for not losing that weight in a particular way. But whether it leads to more or less stigma, time will tell. I mean, this is actually the same concern that came up 10 years ago when obesity was classified as a disease by the American Medical Association. There were concerns that, on the one hand, that this would increase stigma because many people who have a BMI that places them in the obesity category aren't diseased, don't feel diseased. They feel like that label is stigmatizing. And others who felt, wait a second, that disease label is actually going to reduce stigma because it's going to help people recognize that this isn't just about personal control or willpower. What have we seen since then? Like, it's kind of mixed. We're not really seeing it in either direction. You know, we're seeing in some cases that that disease label might be shifting attitudes and knowledge in a little, in small ways, and other ways we're not seeing any effects. So I think that tells us that, you know, weight stigma is much bigger than a medication or whether we call it a disease. Whether those things have a strong, big impact, I think is unlikely because, you know, we live in a society where these negative attitudes and stereotypes have been so strongly ingrained for decades. It's going to take more than, you know, a new medication or a disease label to completely shift that. It really involves many more factors.
No, I think that's a really important point, and especially what you said about weight stigma being so deeply ingrained into our society. So I think that makes some of your work challenging in the sense that, I mean, there's been some progress, as you mentioned, New York City prohibiting weight discrimination last month, I think it was. So the reality then is that we are seeing some progress, spotty progress here and there. But these feel like really intractable issues, and making progress on them over decades, as you said before, you haven't seen as much as you'd like. What keeps you hopeful? What motivates you when it is really a slow push and difficult task to take on?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, you know, first of all, if we look to policy change and societal attitudes about other stigmatized groups, we see how long those efforts have been in play for. So, you know, this isn't atypical when it comes to a stigmatized group. We know that it takes time. So sometimes it's helpful to kind of check that and remind myself that this is how it works. At the same time, you know, I've been at this for over two decades and I have seen considerable changes. And, you know, one of the things that makes me hopeful actually is just how much awareness there is on this issue, particularly in the medical community now. You know, we've had international consensus statements that have been published on this issue, worldwide recognition that this is a problem, and more interest and concerted efforts to educate medical providers about weight bias and how they can really improve supportive and compassionate care to patients of all body sizes. So, you know, there has been progress. There are many more people working in this field than when I started. I think there have, you know, many more collective efforts now in different strategies to try to address this in different settings. So there's groups of people who just focus on this in the media and groups who just focus on this in the school setting. And so, you know, that is really hopeful to me. And I feel like a lot of people have been deputized to really take this work on. And that's really what it's going to take. So, you know, yes, it sometimes feels like one step forward, two steps back, but, you know, the successes are certainly present. And as we start to see these cities and these states become more interested in policy, I think that also tells us that, you know, the public really does view this as a problem that policy remedies are appropriate for.
Well, that's such a great note and a hopeful note as well. And I think that nearly wraps up the episode. But before we go, wanted to ask for your three pieces of advice for students interested in a career pathway like yours.
I think the first thing I would say is say yes to opportunities, even if you're not really sure it fits on the path you're taking. I think it's very easy when we're starting out to have a very narrow idea of what we're going to do and when we're going to do and what that career path is going to look like. I said yes to a project that really wasn't on my research agenda, and it completely changed my career. And so I think it's a time when you can say yes, when you have that flexibility, even if it feels like you don't, you do have that flexibility, and to take those opportunities when they come. I think the second is really about mentorship and what it means to find a good mentor. I think sometimes students expect that a mentor will meet 100% of their needs. And I really like to think about it as a mentoring network model where, you know, your mentor is going to be able to meet some of your new needs, but it's impossible to meet 100% of those needs. So to try to help find other mentors who can meet those other gaps. And a lot of times primary mentors can help you do that. But to really understand what your needs are as a mentee and who can meet those different needs and not have the expectation be that it's going to just be one person. I think that can be really helpful. And then I think the third, which kind of goes, it kind of goes against what I've just said. But at the same time, I think you also really want to start practicing balance. And I know that's hard if you're saying yes to every opportunity that comes your way. And it's harder to do that when you're starting out and really trying to get as much experience as you can. At the same time, I think that there are more people who are in established careers, whether it's medicine, research, healthcare, who really don't have that balance. And if you don't start practicing it early, it's much more difficult to change it later. So even if it's just small pieces that you can integrate into your daily life and making sure that you do have those boundaries, I think that's really important.
What a wonderful note to end on. Thank you so much, Dr. Field. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Make sure to subscribe, rate us, and leave a review. You can also head to the description of this podcast to follow us on all social media so that you don't miss out on any of our content.